Manifesto, a podcast. Your regular visit to the archives of vanity, where men and women who stop making myths turn to issuing proclamations. Your guides for this journey, my co-host, the novelist Phil Klei, and me, the knocker off of tall hats, Jacob Siegel. May you continue to be a person. And here we have old friend, repeat manifesto guest. Guest is perhaps not dignified enough. Honored visitor, Matt Gallagher. Matt, it is an honor to have you back.
Gentlemen, thanks for having me back. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, good to see you, man.
So looking back on the Spanish War, out of all the things to talk about and out of all the Orwell, why this?
Orwell is such an interesting voice, I think, in the 21st century because different versions of him appeal to different people, right? You have Elon Musk and the tech class always citing 1984 because they fear big government. They don't like being taxed. You have kind of the anti-war left often cites his earlier experiences in Burma as an imperial policeman, kind of viewing him as a prophet for anti-colonialism. And then, more recently with what's been happening in Ukraine, I think a lot of people across the political spectrum have found his writings on the Spanish Civil War to be as relevant as ever in terms of seeing a just cause and oppressed people trying to fight for self-determination and their right to a flawed but honest democracy, while a totalitarian force is opposing that, and all the Western governments who have been living in comfort for decades don't really quite know how to handle it. So certainly the specifics differ between now and then. Spain is not Ukraine. Ukraine is not Spain. But there are some general similarities, and I think that's why I thought this essay would be worth revisiting and discussing.
So, and this is the, Homage to Catalonia is published years before this.
Correct.
He publishes Homage to Catalonia shortly after getting back, right? He's shot in the war. He's shot in the neck. And I think he publishes Homage to Catalonia, is it in 38?
That's correct, yep.
Yeah, so that's the book of his immediate visceral recollections and the sort of first order descriptions while it's all, while the nouns are all still fresh. And it reads that way, but it reads that way only if you know how good Orwell is, because it's the composition is extraordinary. I mean, the Homage to Catalonia, you can read in a sitting, and it has that Orwell quality. I don't, you can't say Orwellian quality anymore, but it has that Orwell quality of being simultaneously very conversational and almost clubby, something that somebody might be like delivering, particularly eloquent drunk might be discoursing in a pub, but it's also
that's why Matt likes him,
right, but very very kind of brilliantly composed at the same time. Like the recollections come in a particular order, and it's the right order, but it doesn't feel labored over, and the language certainly doesn't feel labored over. So that's Homage to Catalonia, but this is different, right? This is looking back on the Spanish War, and it contains some of that same kind of, it starts first of all, the physical memories, the sounds, the smells, and the surfaces of things. So it begins in that physical register, but then it goes somewhere else.
Right. There's distance. World War II has begun in earnest at this point. He's writing with some breadth that in wider political understanding that he didn't have in 38 when he wrote literally on his recovery. When he wrote Homage to Catalonia, he was literally on his recovery bed.
And I think that also, I mean, he has a lot of sharper political points to make as he gets into it, but it's almost like he needs to bring himself back to the physical, concrete reality of war before he can sort of earn the right to talk about those other things, or just to remind himself of what war is. You know, he has this passage about how, you know, All Quiet on the Western Front is essentially accurate in terms of the experience of war. Whether the side is that you're fighting for is just or not, that doesn't make much difference to the experience of the soldier moment by moment. A louse is a louse and a bomb is a bomb, even though the cause you are fighting for happens to be just. And it's sort of like, I need to get back to that ground truth before I allow myself to address the propaganda and the ideology and all the things that go on, because that, I think, for him is like the first thing that gets thrown out.
There's also something that struck me when I was rereading this is, you know, when he gets into the politics of in homage to Catalonia, he's, you know, kind of cataloging almost painfully the different factions, the different mm-hmm. groups, not so much on the fascist side, not so much about Franco, but all the forces that are trying to oppose Franco, but also are internally fighting themselves, right? And you know, one of the most famous parts of that book is, you know, kind of documenting the fight that breaks out in Barcelona between hardcore Stalinists versus the anarchists.
Yeah.
This when he does make that switch from what Phil was just describing about the visceral experience of combat, when he switches into the kind of more traditional political writing, his ire is mostly lobbed toward his fellow British classes, right? I mean, the unbridled rage he has for kind of the civilized classes, the intelligentsia, kind of comes up repeatedly. I was really struck by this line in the first section. We have become too civilized to grasp the obvious, for the truth is very simple. To survive, you often have to fight. And to fight, you have to dirty yourself. War is evil, and it is often the lesser evil. Those who take the sword perish by the sword, and those who don't take the sword perish by smelly diseases. You know, it's interesting to me, given, you know, he's writing this in the midst of World War II, after, you know, the Battle of Britain is ongoing, America has entered the war. There is still kind of this hostility that's clearly left over from 1938 for these people who did not see this coming, or he kind of very eloquently makes the case that they did their best to avoid it seeing it coming.
Right, and this is where the connection between the first-order experience and the geopolitical analysis is direct, because the same complaint, the same charge he's lobbing against the British intelligentsia, he's lobbing against Britain as a nation in its relation to the Spanish Republican cause, right? And so the essay is divided into seven parts with a kind of, I don't know if you would call it an eighth. I don't think he formally, it's seven stanzas, and then there's a poem at the end, which is a kind of coda. But those seven stanzas,
not a good poem. Not a good poem.
It's a wonderful essay, and you get to the poem and you're like, oh, didn't really stick the landing, man.
So there are lines in it that I like, but we'll come back to that. And I knew that this would come up. It's nice that
you're going to have to defend the poem.
Well, look, it's like you have to take into account how much am I enjoying knocking Orwell for like bad writing on something, like, you know, I got him, you know what I mean? Like his poem is bad. Let me take advantage of this. But the seven stanzas, leaving the poem aside for a second, don't have a clear thematic progression. This is part of what makes him so great. And they move back and forth in this way that feels almost meandering. Conversational is a better word. There's a sort of natural flow that connects them, but no formal hierarchy. And they go from the personal, the experiential, to class analysis, to geopolitics, to a discussion of the place of atrocity in war. And where he gets to the geopolitics, which is later in the essay, there is a connection, I think, between this charge against the British, you know, the sort of nominally pro-Republican, anti-Francoist British intelligentsia, and then Britain as a nation, which has sort of pretended to offer a kind of half-hearted support, a half-hearted resistance to fascism, while doing just enough, perhaps, to inflame things further, but clearly not nearly enough to make any kind of difference in the war.
Right. The that side which had arms would win. The Nazis and the Italians gave arms to their Spanish fascist friends and the Western democracies, and the Russians didn't give arms to those who should have been their friends. So the Spanish Republic perished, having gained what no republic missed. A reference to Robert Browning's apparent failure. But I mean, that feels, I don't know, with the current holdup of support for Ukraine, that feels very, very resonant today. Where, you know, it's like they don't have enough ammunition, right? And the Western democracies, in particular the United States, might sort of agree that the this side is in the right, but are not really helping. And I think that one of the threads that kind of connects it through is there's kind of like the ground material realities, not just the physical experience of war, which he begins with, but also like material interests. And then there's the plasticity of the intelligentsia, which enrages him. You know, and he starts off talking about how, you know, after he, you know, he gives you what war is like, he complains about like, the romantic warmongering muck that our left-wingers were spilling at the time, all the stale old phrases and the unimaginative callousness of it all, right? Despite the fact that after 1918, if there was one thing that the British intelligentsia was committed to, it was the debunking version of war, right? The idea that war is all corpses and latrines and never leaves anything good. And that they just kind of like turned on a dime as soon as the cause, you know, became one that they supported. And, you know, war went from hell to being war is glorious, you know, without any intervening stage. And then the atrocity connection is when, you know, he's like, I've been like looking at these lists of atrocities and the left and the right like to publicize them and they never seem to believe in the same atrocities, right?
No, you have to be so far removed historically that there's no meaningful moral agency involved at all anymore to get a political agreement on what constitutes an atrocity. There has to be no politics left at all. It has to have, you know, the blood has to be fossilized for there to be any kind of agreement. But the thing you're describing about the kind of left-wing position on war going from this, first of all, I mean, if you go, so Phil, you were starting at the left being very anti-war, which parts of the left were anti-war even before World War I, right? And through all of World War I, you know, the labor movement, the Wobblies in the U.S., Eugene Debs, was imprisoned for his anti-war efforts during the First World War and for attempting to keep the U.S. out of World War I. The famous
huge, huge peace movement in the latter half of the 19th century, and
the peace movement. I mean, to be clear about the politics of it, the peace movement in the U.S. in World War I is led by the left. It's a largely left-wing movement as a mass movement. The the congressional politics are actually different. It's a largely right-wing movement inside of Congress that's opposed to entering World War I, but the mass movement led by Debs and the Wobblies is a kind of left-wing labor
and socialist movement. Tolstoy is an important part of this.
People like, you know, important leftists, including people like H.G. Wells, then they go from anti-war to pro-war during the war. Then they become anti-war. You know, then there's this swing towards a very hard anti-war position after the horrors of World War I. Then they become pro-war again. And this is the romantic turn that Orwell is describing when the Spanish Civil War starts. But then there's another anti-war turn. There's an anti-war turn directed at casting German aggression, you know, Hitlerite German aggression as being no threat to Britain or the great powers, right? Like there's a significant, this is partly a product of the sort of a Soviet Nazi detente and the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, but it actually precedes that. And there's a kind of left-wing pacifist movement that, you know, kind of dismisses tales of Nazi aggression as being merely pro-war propaganda. So there's a constant positional shifting about extolling the glories of war or decrying anybody who defends warfare as a hideous warmonger, bloodthirsty warmonger. That's completely dictated and scripted by politics.
Think about the trench poets or, you know, Wilfred Owen and the old lie, right? You know, that it's glorious to die for your country versus Auden, this is from Spain. Tomorrow for the young poets, for the young, the poets exploding like bombs, the walks by the lake, the weeks of perfect communion. Tomorrow the bicycle races through the suburbs on summer evenings. But today the struggle. Today the deliberate increase in the chances of death, the conscious acceptance of guilt and the necessary murder. Today the expending of powers on the flat ephemeral pamphlet and the boring meeting. Yeah.
The Auden was pro-war, by the way.
Yeah. Well, Auden is more sophisticated and complicated than a lot of the folks that he's complaining about.
What's the poem Auden wrote that Orwell mentions? Spain.
Orwell liked that poem. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we've lived versions of this ourselves, right? The anti-war marches in 2003. Suddenly, I don't know, a year and a half later, remember John Kerry's campaign? Like we were more patriotic. Right. That was the push, and then it didn't quite work. Obama gets catapulted to the Democratic front runner specifically because he has a very firm anti-war position as opposed to Hillary Clinton.
He'd opposed the Iraq War. He doesn't have an anti-war position, right? He said he was opposed to dumb wars.
Those things got very right. Cleverly done. Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, then, of course, as you both have written very, very sharply about this, we have 8 years of war during Obama's two terms. It just doesn't feel that way here in the States. Right. I mean, this is, and then, you know, going forward into the Trump administration, and say what you will about Trump, and I've said plenty of bad things. One thing he does seem to firmly believe is in kind of like withdrawing from foreign conflicts, and believes in kind of a version of America first, of, you know, the Britain first that Orwell holds to task in this essay. And now we're here, right? It's this fascinating time when the far left has a war resistance they support. Liberals and centrists have a war that they support. And then you have the MAGA right, which seems to be more interested in a domestic civil war. But we all we've become
And the fringes
kind of
seem to almost support Russia, which is really bizarre.
That's true. I can't tell how much of that is just online cosplay and how much of that is real. I don't know.
There's been a long among the intelligentsia, a certain weakness for dictators and strongmen. Like this is like Orwell actually talks about this, right? Like in the piece, but you know, from like Mencken supporting Germany in World War I, Buckley and Bazell loving Franco, Jean Kirkpatrick blaming the American nuns for their own rape and murder.
Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound, Russell Kirk supporting apartheid. And then, you know, the sort of left-wing versions of this with certain fascinations with like Castro and Chavez as he's like taking apart Venezuelan democracy.
Recently with Assad, what I was thinking of when I was reading.
Yeah, the bizarre gray zone guys. Like,
it's broader than that. Yeah, but it's broader than that. And that, you know,
there's no atrocity that they won't defend. Yeah, as long as it sort of has a faintly
all atrocity.
Guys are very fringe, but yeah.
I don't know. And I think that there was also there was a pro-Assad segment of the right as well.
Right. And, or you think about what's that woman, Breonna Joy Gray,
yes.
Who, you know, needs like. Footage from nine different angles and rape kits to believe that Hamas might have raped anybody.
It's not just that. She's also, right, and she's also, you know, there's now a, like, Houthi faction of the DSA, and so there's, like, it's, like, trans rights, climate crisis, healthcare for all, death to America, death to the Jews. This is the sort of... the basis of intersectionality, but
I'm going to raise an objection to that particular framing, but go forward.
Well, I'm not endorsing that platform. I'm saying that I think that there is a the number of prominent people on the left who were celebrating the Houthis as the defenders of Palestine and as the like vanguard of anti-imperialism is not insignificant. The thing that this comes back to is something Orwell discusses at the beginning of the essay, which is where he says in the first section, as far as the mass of the people go, the extraordinary swings of opinion which occur nowadays, the emotions which can be turned on and off like a tap, are the result of newspaper and radio hypnosis. Now, I think that maybe hypnosis is not the word I would use, but the thing that he's describing, this enormous sort of swell of public opinion, which creates fervors for or against particular wars colored by partisan feeling, of course, is new, right? So this is a very new thing. This does not exist before the 20th century. There are, of course, sort of mass emotional phenomena, affective phenomena that can be traced back centuries earlier. But the ability of the media, the radio, print media, to address a public which had not existed before the 20th century, right? This idea of a kind of listening, reading public is a very new thing. And that's, we're still living with that, but that's something quite new. And I see that as part of what Orwell's writing about here.
I mean, that feels so current, right? I mean, like, that it's done with radio almost makes it quaint, you know? But
newspapers, right? Like, he's naming the different newspapers and identifying their political leanings and who they appeal to, right? I mean, that's part of our world. Like, that's ingrained in our world. And to Jake's point, was new. And he, you know, part of Orwell's appeal is that he's the one calling it out.
And it's part of why you get this kind of ideological factionalism, or this you have these mass opinion formations, mass political formations that correspond to different movements within and manipulations of media. And the result of that, as he discusses in the latter part of the essay, is not just that there's a complete partisan divergence over what constitutes an atrocity. It's also, as he deals with later, that history becomes a site of endless contestation, right? He talks toward the end of the essay about, like, how are we possibly going to arrive at anything like a truthful historical account? And he's not a naive. He says, look, I understand that historians, even in the pre-modern era, were colored by their own biases, had their own objectives, could only ever ascertain a partial truth. But they had in their heads the idea of something like history. They had in their heads the idea of something like a truthful reckoning with what had occurred and an obligation to that truthful reckoning. And how can we ever have anything like that now?
You know, I didn't necessarily agree with him on that, right? I mean, I think it's always contestation, but I thought of that line and I thought of the bit about atrocities, right? Where he's talking about how, you know, the atrocities are believed in or disbelieved in solely on the grounds of political predilection, right? You know, you believe in the atrocities of your enemy and you disbelieve in those your own side. And I thought about that in relation to this article that Gabriel Winant wrote after October 7th. Right, where he argued essentially that you shouldn't publicly grieve the victims of October 7th, right? American leftists, American Jews. And he said that Hamas's victims are, we might darkly say, pre-grieved. That is, an apparatus is already in place to take their deaths and give them not just any meaning, but specifically the meaning that they can find in the bombs falling on Gaza. for what it means is that it is not possible to publicly grieve an Israeli Jewish life lost to violence without tithing ideologically to the IDF, whether you like it or not. And this was a source of heated intra-left debate, right? And I found it to be a kind of repulsive argument, but also a fascinating one, because on the one hand, there is something that is sort of, it is obviously true that particular types of atrocities are either convenient or politically inconvenient, right? You see this after mass shooters, right? That the particular character of the mass shooter can make them useful to the left or useful to the right, right? Can this be characterized as terrorism? Is this like the mass shooter who was the Bernie fan, right, who attacked congressional Republicans? Or is it racially motivated? Is it this sort of thing? And depending on the nature of the individual's derangement, it makes it either useful deaths or not useful deaths, right? And that's just sort of a fact in the world that you need to, that just can be acknowledged. And then Wine goes from there to this kind of like practical prescription, which is like, you should not actually respond to these horrific murders and the way that a human should, which on the one level, I think in terms of practical politics is really stupid, right? Because sort of, you know, if you looked at what sort of very stridently pro-Israel, pro-aggressive military response from Israel folks were highlighting after October 7th, all the time they were highlighting the Gabriel Weinerts of the world, the people who were minimizing the atrocity because they knew that it made them look bad. So I think as a practical prescription, it's not as sophisticated as Weinert thinks that he's being. But I did find it fascinating to see the argument just put forward straightforwardly that you're kind of, if the human response to a basic thing might be used wrong or will certainly be used for a political cause that you don't like, you know, his argument is essentially the left should educate the public to reject their basic humanity and furtherance of their further goals, right? And it's a more sophisticated version of the, well, I'm just not going to believe in the atrocities committed by...
I was thinking the exact same thing. It's the evolution of what Orwell is kind of trying to hold to task, trying to mock when he writes, atrocities are believed in or disbelieved in solely on grounds of political predilection, right? This is putting ideology before people and doing it with self-awareness.
Right. It's more malevolent. Right. Like it's more malevolent because it's saying it doesn't matter whether it happened or not. But I doubt that it had any practical effect. I think that that essay is part of a very, very small, fairly insular discourse among a group of people who are radically interested in themselves and their own kind of the one thing that they're good at, which is a kind of mediocre reworking of other people's ideas and glib dehumanization, posturing as some sort of radical politics. But I think, you know, it's a despicable sentiment.
I'm surprised to hear you say that. I would have thought that you would be a big fan.
Well, look, I could disagree with it and think that it's significant. In this case, I think I think it's insignificant. It's essentially the kind of tune being played by people whose importance, such as it is, you know, and there's not much importance, but depends entirely on this calumny of Israel, right? These are people for whom the only significance they can achieve requires on these grand ideological gestures of calumny and anathematizing the Zionist project. They don't actually know anything about Zionism. I mean, that piece, in addition to being, despicable, was also based on a grossly stupid, historically illiterate reading of what Zionism is and what Israel is now. Like, this idea that it's only by exploiting the grieving of Jewish victimhood. I mean, this is like, you couldn't actually sit down and familiarize yourself with the history of political Zionism, and even in only its late 19th and early 20th century versions, and come away believing that. But this is a kind of small-minded, position that like works in these unimportant places and gets attention for being objectionable and for being for flirting with a kind of radical like dehumanization as the appropriate political stance to take.
Okay, but to be more serious, right? Like, that's the extreme version of it, and I think it's easy to dismiss, right? Nonetheless, like, we all do face this sort of challenge, right? Which is, there are atrocities in the world, there are horrors.
Yes.
And which ones do you emphasize? Which ones do you need to describe?
Yes. And I'm as susceptible to that as anyone, but I would never make a principle of my own moral failings and blindness. And it's precisely, no, I'm serious. It's his position is not, I am ideologically hostile to Israel, therefore I care less about Israeli deaths than I do about other deaths. His position is, some human lives are worth less than others. And in fact, these human lives are politically questionable. And so even to award them their full humanness. Now, do I engage in that? Do I dehumanize Palestinians when I justify warfare? I do. Anytime you justify any war, you are relying on a kind of implicit dehumanization. If you were confronted with the full humanity of the people. Look, the single best part of the Orwell essay, for my money, the part that will stick with me forever, is he's in a trench, okay?
Airplanes
are going overhead, and a fascist pops up, a fascist. Meaning the guy who's fighting on the fascist side. Yeah, go ahead and read it.
Yeah, he's gone out specifically to snipe at fascists, right? And it's in a dangerous position. And that's what they're there to do, is to just wait to somebody to pop up, and if they get a chance to kill a fascist. And the planes go overhead, and it is right at that moment that this one guy, seeing the planes, gets up. He's holding his trousers with both hands as he's run. Clearly, he's like, either getting dressed or taking a crap or whatever. I refrained from shooting at him. It is true that I'm a poor shot and unlikely to hit a running man at 100 yards, and also that I was thinking chiefly about getting back to our trench while the fascists had their attention fixed on the airplanes. Still, I did not shoot partly because of that detail about the trousers. I'd come here to shoot at fascists, but a man who is holding up his trousers isn't a fascist. He is visibly a fellow creature, similar to yourself, and you don't feel like shooting at him.
That part's great. My favorite vivid scene of the war recollections is when he's made corporal. Orwell has made corporal.
Yeah.
And there's he tries to order a unruly soldier to a fighting position, and the soldier objects. And there's this whole debate in the squad of, in a army of the people, in a non-bourgeois,
he starts pulling the guy over, and they're like, military. "You're being a fascist,
right? Yeah. Can you do this? You're not allowed to take orders." You're not allowed to give orders. And the soldier that rises most to his defense is the 16-year-old working class boy. Some of Orwell's descriptions of the working class here probably have not aged super well. Comparing them to a plant comes to mind, right? Mindlessly reaching for the sun. But he does make a pretty passionate case, I think, that they are really the only true, in the long run, kind of the only true anti-fascist that can be counted on.
Because the intellectuals will get bribed.
No, the exact same people you all were just describing, that have spent the last 2 years, whether with Gaza or Ukraine, you have just spent,
you know, this entire time navel gazing, arguing theoreticals, not actually seeking out to go practically help somebody in these war zones that they
let me read the
pretend to care so much about
that bit from the
Orwell.
When one thinks of all the people who support or have supported fascism, one stands amazed at their diversity. What a crew! Think of a program which, at any rate for a while, could bring Hitler, Petain, Montague Norman, Pavlich, William Randolph Hearst, Stryker, Bookman, Ezra Pound, Juan March, Cocteau, Tyson, Father Coughlin, the Mufti of Jerusalem, Arnold Lunn, Antonescu, Spengler, Beverly Nichols, Lady Houston, and Marinetti all into the same boat. But the clue is really very simple. They're all people with something to lose, or people who long for a hierarchical society and dread the prospect of a world of free and equal human beings.
But look, we could also talk about this in reference to Ukraine, where I know you've spent some time, Matt, and I think there are some similarities, not only in terms of what Orwell is talking about, but also in the sense of a unusual relationship between Washington and Kiev that has emerged over the last, really not even just since this war, but that, you know, there is a relationship between the U.S. and Kiev that is at once sort of all important and also, you know, to my mind, quite misleading in the sense that we combine this sort of appearance of maximalist support. We combine this maximalist rhetoric towards Ukraine, which has, you know, also included calling for regime change in Russia, with a totally inadequate degree of material support where ends and means are completely untethered from one another and in some ways makes the situation worse.
It has been a bipartisan failure, I think, with supplying Ukraine. I mean, the focus right now is and should be on the very, very odd Republican Congress and approach towards this, trying to package it with the border bill. And then as soon as that actually gets put together, then running away from it, you know, entangling, like, you know, just reckless irresponsibility. But before that, you know, Jake Sullivan and others within the Biden administration have made it a habit of half measures, of not trust, you know, is Ukraine an ally or not, right? Kind of overmanaging it, constantly giving them maybe half or a quarter of HIMARS or air defense missiles. Artillery certainly is the big shortage that I saw along the front just in this past August and has gotten even worse. It's fascinating because it's just a classic American mistake of overmanagement, fearing secondary and tertiary effects where, you know, the big what if right now for a lot of Ukrainians and for people that pay attention to this is, you know, back in fall of 2022, where it was that sudden momentum, they seized back Kherson in the south. They got a lot of Kharkiv Oblast in the north, northeast. If they'd been properly supplied, if they'd been given everything they wanted, then, you know, they could have really, you know, pushed Russia even farther, pushed Russia to the point where they have to maybe consider negotiation, because it was that winter where they were able to put in all the minefield, with the winter freeze that set in, they were able to dig in and entrench themselves with just miles and miles of minefields. And now, you know, the war is frankly, for strategic reasons and geopolitical reasons, to their incremental advantage.
What do you make of the argument, Matt, that Washington was opposed to the negotiations at that point?
I think that's kind of rubbish. I think it's more of a genuine fear. I mean, their decision making is rooted in a genuine fear of, you know, Russia was making a lot of noise about detonating a tactical nuke, right, which would change all kinds of things. But ultimately, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, but I felt this way even then. Do we if we trust the Ukrainian government, Ukrainian military enough to be support? We're already there, right? We're, you know, if we're already kind of involved with this, we need to trust them on the supply level to actually listen to them and give them what they're requesting. Just kind of a constant mistake of half measures of believing we know better than they do, and it's who's paid the price for this? Dead Ukrainian soldiers and dead Ukrainian civilians.
And when and where were you in Ukraine? What's
I've kind of been all over. That initial trip in February and March 2022, when we went as volunteers, we were strictly in Lviv. Our second trip,
which is Lviv, is in the west, right? So that's
in the west,
and that's where
I'll do a better
training
job.
Was going on there.
Yeah, we worked with just a kind of a group of civilians on real basic self-defense. I went back as a journalist in October and November of 2022 with Ben Bush as my photographer. We went Kyiv, Odessa, Mykolaiv, Kharkiv, that trip, and greater Kharkiv kind of really soon after it had been liberated. And then the most recent trip, which was August, we went out to Bakhmut, Kherson, Dnipro, up in Sumy, which is in the far north, just kind of drove down kind of the entirety of what then was then and is still mostly the front line to interview different Ukrainians.
Did you get a sense from the Ukrainians you spoke with that they had a clear, not even clear, that what was the end state they were pursuing? Was it did they think it was possible to push Russia out entirely? Were they trying to gain enough battlefield advantage to force negotiations that would be acceptable to them? What were you hearing?
That was the central question I asked them all, and I got a range of opinions. One of the great things about a free open society is you're going to get a range of opinions. Some people said we want to fight this till we get Crimea back. Most people, the closer you got to the front, frankly, the more people were a bit skeptical of that. I think the general consensus was we need to get the momentum back to force negotiations. I'd say the most honest answer, the one that surprised me the most, because it came from a friend Ukrainian, a true believer. He's a platoon, the equivalent of a platoon leader, fighting up in Sumy. He talked very kind of forthrightly about he believes that kind of the international body is going to force a peace deal upon Ukraine. That's going to result in a lot of land being given to Russia, but that it's really not going to be a peace deal, that it's just more of a tactical pause, that, you know, the issues here, the historical issues, the economic issues, so much of this is because Putin wants the mines in Donbas, right? Wants access to all the grain fields in central Ukraine. The cultural and historical stuff is very real, but there's also kind of an economic element to this that I don't think the Western press has done a good job reporting. Anyways, my friend thinks that there will be kind of a forced peace deal coming in the next year or two, but that it'll just be kind of a pause, that both sides understand that another phase of the war awaits in the net, whether it's 5, 10, 15 years from now. He compared it to 2014. When the Russians initially pushed into Donbas, that we're not gearing towards anything like a lasting peace, in part because of Western overmanagement. And it's a depressing thing to think. He was talking. He's a young father like we are, and he was talking very forthrightly about what that's going to mean for his 8-year-old, 6-year-old boy, growing up. Not just with the vague idea that they might become a soldier, but like almost with the certainty that he's going to be fighting along his sons here in 12, 15 years. It was depressing, but it was honest. It was real.
What's his attitude towards the Donbass regions?
He's from the West, and he's kind of gotten, he's personally over it. He says that, frankly, that any person from that area originally has already made a choice of who they want to, whether they want to be Ukrainian or Russian. I met other Western Ukrainians that would disagree with that and push back forthrightly. An injured veteran, very injured veteran that I interviewed in Lviv, which is where he's originally from, said, to be honest with you, before I fought in the war, I thought they were different. I thought they were different people ethnically, culturally, Russian speaking, whatever. It wasn't until I went out there and I met them and I saw the region that I truly believed this is Ukraine. And it was worth fighting for. It was worth losing my friends for. It was worth almost losing my life for. So there is internal disagreement on that, even amongst Western Ukrainian military veterans. So that disagreement courses through their society.
Yeah.
So we should move to our art, which is, and by the way, it's worth noting, Matt has a novel that is phenomenal, Daybreak, which takes you through some of this. And I wanted to bring that up because it's this thing that, you know, Orwell has, which is just like about seeing everything. And in that novel, you're pretty strong supporter of Ukraine, Matt. It's a brilliant novel. It follows two American veterans who didn't get what they wanted from their wars, right? And go to Ukraine. You know, one of them seems to be looking for a sense of purpose, and the other one never got to kill anybody while he was in Afghanistan. And he's the one who's really useful to the Ukrainians, actually, which is like this wonderful, you know, they're like, you, we can use, right? Like you, and you, the guy looking for purpose, I'm not so sure about you. But you know, you take us through some of.
And when is this?
Various different things,
February 2022. So right when the renewed invasion came.
Okay.
You take us through some of the more unsavory aspects of things too, and I wanted to ask about your decision to include the character of Dog. If you could talk a little bit about that in the book, and
yeah,
whether this was related to your love of Orwell.
I'm sure it's related to my love of Orwell. It wasn't a conscious choice, but I'm sure these things are, you know, he's certainly one of the writers that inspired me, not just as a writer, but as a human being. And, you know, so of course, you know, his work, among others, is kind of always there. So Dog is a Ukrainian nationalist, right-wing paramilitary leader. And he has a conversation with our very awkward, sweet, confused American protagonist about war and about the history of Ukraine and Russia. And I think it was important for me to include. He enters pretty late in the book. I've already kind of introduced readers to different elements of Ukrainian society, but you know, people fighting for the force of good, and it's a cause I believe in. I believe in Ukraine's right for self-determination, and you know, find this, frankly, to be a conflict that's about as close to black and white as we can possibly get in the 21st century. Though, of course, you know, as Phil has written, there's no such thing as a good war, but sometimes there are necessary wars. But including Dog was important to show that there are some unsavory elements, even for a good cause, that bad people fight for a good cause. That is the way of the world. That is the way any war is going to be. Dog is both a profiteer, but also at one point killed a Russian soldier, and has not stopped talking about it ever since. it's ugly, but you need ugly people fighting in those trenches. And I knew that including him would probably upset some Ukrainian friends of mine, would probably limit my readership. But I had, you know, I didn't want to write a fairy tale. I didn't want to write propaganda. I wanted to write a serious war novel, and including a character like that in a conflict, even like this, was the only choice.
Your Ukrainian friends who you imagine would be upset, how did they understand the role of the, you know, I don't know, Azov or the right wing militias in general? That it's what do they say? How do they look at it?
They view it as so much of this is like not just with an ongoing war, but like writing about an ongoing war is kind of adds a whole different layer to it. You know, that had not been my experience with my previous books. I was writing about Iraq after the fact. As for my Ukrainians. Friends' kind of stances toward those militias, Azov. There's a battle for memory going on. You know, they were the heroism they displayed in Mariupol was so real and such a national rallying cry. It's very hard, even to get people that trust you immensely, for them to they'll say, yeah, okay, Azov was founded that way in 2014, but they've been weeded out. They've rebranded. They're now called like the Third Assault Brigade. I interviewed, you know, real tough looking volunteer soldier for them outside of Bakhmut, who told me point blank, you know, all those guys are killed or, you know, are killed or wounded now. So it's been flushed out of the unit.
And then B, you know, Ukrainian Nazis would not exist if it weren't for Americans and Europeans. That's not true, right?
What did he mean by that? I don't understand.
That it's become, and there is some truth to this. Like with everything, it's always complicated, right? That maybe a small issue, you know, any open society is going to have extremists, and an element of those extremists are ready and willing to fight. America, God knows we know that in the American military, some of the things we have to weed out sometimes. And that it has been overblown in Western media, that a small issue has become magnified. And there is some truth to this. A friend of mine who has worked as a journalist in Ukraine since 2014 told me, you know, for years between, say, 2016 and 2022, the only way you could get Western editors to pay attention to a story about Ukraine was if you had an extremism element to it. So people, I think this third assault soldier was overstating his case by saying it's only on us. Because, of course, you know, there's elements to truth to that, right? Like, nobody made them make their initial symbol the wolf's angel. That was on them. But I also think there is some truth that this has become completely magnified and exploited by the Kremlin, frankly, to delegitimize a legitimate cause.
Yeah, no, it's also in the way that these things work, where great power politics are refracted through these ideological formations. You have all of these people who have taken up the sort of cause of Russia as anti-imperialist power, and, you know, or the multipolar power, Russia as this sort of the force that is going to put an end to American unipolarity and create the multipolar world. And they then vigorously take up the cause of proving that all of Ukraine is nothing but neo-Nazis in a way that is almost more passionate than the Kremlin's, you know, the Kremlin can just like throw this stuff out and walk away. But then you have these people who their whole emotional life, inner life sort of gets filled up with these causes. And they really, you know, they take it to heart, right? It's not just propaganda to them. It becomes a kind of something that touches on their inner life in some way.
Yeah, God bless the devout anti-imperialist who supports Russia of all countries blindly, and all Russian aggression toward nations trying to break away by themselves. And you know, the reality, because it's personal, right, on both sides. I mean, a number of Ukrainians I talked to and interviewed have cousins in Russia, and you know, vice versa, right? Like there is kind of an interconnected family aspect to this. You know, if you read Putin, I think it was 2020, Putin wrote an essay about this. He legitimately doesn't believe Ukraine is a country or a free speaking people. Like they want Ukrainians to want them. And they're going to destroy, they want them to want them so much, they're willing to destroy all of it to get them back, which is a different, it's deeply fucked up, but is a very different relationship to this war than kind of the Western style, quote unquote, anti-imperialist that you're talking
about. Yeah, I mean, I don't take those people, you know, particularly seriously, but it, like they've taken to that cause. I mean, remember that the original Russian pretext was denazification, right? Like this has sort of been swept away now, and that like the emphasis got shifted to NATO encroachment, but the denazification was central to the Russian pro-war rhetoric in the early stages. We need to denazify Ukraine. We can do that by decapitating the regime, essentially, and installing a pro-Kremlin regime. And this has sort of been forgotten now because these things, yeah.
It's done very intentionally. My friend, the poet Boris Dralyuk, who's originally from Odessa, explained this to me. Like the one historical thing from the leftover from the Soviet Union that every generation of Ukrainian and Russian can agree on is that we defeated Nazi Germany. It is a huge point of pride in both countries. You know, every little town and village in Ukraine that we drove through the center square had a monument to World War II and the vanquishers of Nazism. It is a huge point of connection and you know, really the one thing left that can kind of unite these very disparate elements.
Can we use that to jump off the Bush? Because we need to talk about
Let's do it.
Bush, nine dialogues, conflict in context. He's a writer, photographer, actor, Marine vet, really interesting guy, has amazing hair, good dude. And the opening photo is this like graffiti, photo of graffiti where there's at the bottom, it's 1945 and there's a swastika in red, and then 1991, a hammer and sickle, and then 2002 with a question mark Z. And I wondered if you could talk about Ben Bush's photos from his trips in 2002 and 2023 in Ukraine, and why you wanted to pair these in particular with the Orwell.
So Ben has been with me on every one of my trips to Ukraine. He was our lead trainer. He's a retired lieutenant colonel from the Marines for that first trip. And then he was kind of my photographer slash bodyguard, making sure I wasn't kidnapped by being too much of a dope on my second and third trip. And what was fascinating is, you know, here's a fellow artist, doing the exact same thing I am. You know, it was just the two of us and our interpreter for 98% of these reporting trips. And he just approaches things from such a different way than I do. I was very conversation focused. I was always kind of like worried about missing a meeting or you know, already kind of piecing together these different profiles that, you know, ended up in Esquire. Ben is kind of more of a observational type of artist, right? He needed to be kind of immersed in a place and a scene. These photos that he put together for War Literature and the Arts as a gallery. I mean, these are he was fascinated with kind of the war propaganda within Ukraine and how it changed even over, you know, one of the passages he explains how that's starting to disappear. These posters are starting to disappear from Western Ukraine because even that, you know, that part of the country is trying to kind of separate itself from the conflict as much as it can. And he was seeing this through the fraying and the fraying of the posters, fraying of the changing of the images and the graffiti and the billboards. And it was just really interesting revisit. You know, I've walked past every one of those images, everything he described, I remember being at, but it was such a different experience seeing it through his eyes. I remember yelling
it's,
at like
it's
the
really
best photo in there.
Yeah.
The best photo in there for my money is the devastation outside of Kharkiv.
Mm-hmm.
And he found the one Coca-Cola ad.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just this beautiful photo of the war's ruin, but you know, just also how deeply, deeply destroyed the east part of Kharkiv city was. And I was shouting at him from the car because we needed to make an interview. Right. And I was furious with him. And then there's this beautiful piece of art that came out of it. And I was like, I was humbled. I was glad he pretended like a dog. He pretended not to hear me.
So these were presented. Where's the gallery where these were actually presented? It's not just online, right?
No. I believe the opening is going to be in Traverse City, Michigan.
Okay.
But he's lining up a couple different gallery presentations across the country.
They're really striking, and you can find them online at wlajournal.com.
Yeah, we'll put the link. We'll put the link in the show notes.
They're startling, and they're not what you expect when you are going into a gallery of photos about the photojournalist who's been traveling through Ukraine during the war. It's not the photographs you expect.
Right. It's not kind of conventional war photography. He talks about how he references Vermeer, and he says, you know, it's like unlike the sort of savagery horrors of Goya paintings. He's going for this moment where the private becomes public. And then he also talks about how he's looking to photograph objects that are already framed, I think is how he puts it, something like that. So you have all of these photographs of art objects or of things hung on walls, and it it creates you know, this interesting effect of the enclosure of the enclosure.
There's one that is, it's a photograph of an advertisement in the window of a gun shop. The sort of pane of the window almost comes down like the bars of a cell, and you see sort of like, you know, just a little bit of the of what's around this window, and it's, and the advertisement is the torso of a woman wrapped in a Ukrainian flag holding a gun. And he notes that few Ukrainians had had weapons, had firearms before the invasion, right? It's not like America. Ukraine will soon have millions of traumatized veterans, returning refugees, civilian survivors of assault. It will also be a nation flooded with guns. Seeing a woman wrapped in their flag, a pistol held in the center, had much to say to me. They framed it and I reframed it.
I was going to say, Ben is a deeply ethical man. And So much of this, he has a very kind of committed artistic vision. You know, he saw more than his fair share of armed violence as a Marine in Ramadi. And I think he explained it to me one time, I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to put words in his mouth, of like, he's kind of more interested in the stories about war that a society tells itself to keep fighting it.
Yeah.
You know, another real powerful photo from the gallery is the photo of the real young man at his gravesite with his Doberman, right? Mm-hmm. The young man's, the killed soldier's family chose to memorialize him with, you know, he's wearing just kind of his military undershirt. He's a little chubby, but, you know, probably 18, 19 years old, and he's with his dog. And, you know, we make a point of visiting that cemetery every time we go, and it's, you know, you can't help it but lose it every time. You know, taking a photo of that framed, it's not just about the dead soldier. It's about the family took the time to frame that particular photo, and that's how they're memorializing him too. I think is what just kind of elevates Ben's work.
Yeah, the closest thing you find to a kind of conventional war photograph, and it's telling that this is the closest, is the image of you'll help me with the name, Matt. It's a government center building in Mykolaiv. Is that how you pronounce it? So Mykolaiv government center after it sustained a direct missile hit. And it's a ground level view from inside a hallway of a sort of narrow corridor, the carpet of which is covered in shattered glass. And there's this wreckage inside the building. And what's interesting about it to me, and what makes it stand out, and like your eyes don't just pass over it as kind of standard war wreckage, is first of all, the fact that it's ground level, sort of like it brings you down to the level of what has been destroyed. So rather than shooting it from above, where you as the observer are still intact, looking at something that's been ripped apart, you're now on the ground, you know, with what's been shattered. And then it's the fact that it's like inside the hallway of the government building. And so there's something like intimate and like, you know, the sort of bureaucratic routine that you associate with a hallway like that, all of a sudden destroyed in an instant.
Yeah, and it's paired with another one where he notes, what is rarely noted when we see urban rubble is the glass. It's hard to describe how the ground becomes a shattered mirror speckled with sky, people walking past broken into hundreds of reflections. I'm fascinated by how something we take for granted as invisible is suddenly transformed into such a complex material, as if the windows are forming crystals rather than holding the last shards. I wanted an image that captured these sculptural forms left as aftermath, foreground and background both represented, but I'm not.
Yeah, no, both those photos and pairing them, I think, was a brilliant decision. And it was fascinating because they're from different trips. The Mykolaiv one was from our second trip, first as journalists. And the backstory to that is that almost, like, by 10 minutes, he missed it. It almost killed the governor of the region, Vitaly Kim, who's of Korean descent and has kind of become a very public anti-Putin, pro-Ukrainian public figure since. And the Ukrainians have kind of left that government center almost as a monument, like untouched, to remind themselves, to remind visitors of how close, you know, and people were killed there. I think upwards of 20 were killed there. And then that second, the one that Phil mentioned,
That strike happened like maybe a day or two before we got there, in a very small village called Pokrovsk. And I mean, it was, he took that shot amidst Red Cross volunteers helping families sort together what remained of their apartments. A pizzeria had been targeted. This was when they were targeting big hangouts for Western journalists and aid workers, which was, you know, foremost on our minds, of course. So we tried to get off the beaten path as a result. But it was, you know, finding that image, you know, one was kind of this very kind of settled in archaic monument to war's destruction. And then that second one was fresh as can be, and finding, you know, being able to find these kind of like beautiful but tragic images in the midst of that, it's, you know, it's a man at his craft at his best.
Do you know, like, what's his method? He's walking around, and is he with you? He's accompanying you to photograph for the stories you're working on. I'm just curious how he's coming to the places that he ends up photographing.
A point of contention on our trips, because he was supposed, you know, he'd be there with me, and you know, he God bless him, he would do kind of the standard profile, you know, profile pics and everything. But like one time, this happened a lot, but the one anecdote that comes to mind is we were up in Kharkiv, and we'd been warned by a Ukrainian intelligence officer to be very careful that Russians were operating in the city looking to grab Western journalists, right? So we weren't speaking English on the street. We were trying to stay incognito as much as one can with Ben's hair and wearing a Led Zeppelin hat. dude, you're not blending in at all.
Listeners will have to see Ben's hair. It's awesome. when he left the Marine Corps, he went all the way.
He went full hair, yeah. We stopped to exchange money, and I turn around, I swear to God, I just stopped. It was like 30 seconds. I turn around and he's just gone. And we couldn't find him for like 40 minutes. I was already kind of going through, I got to call the State Department, like all kinds of just terrible, terrible stuff. And he just kind of pops around a corner. I'm full of Irish rage. And he just looks at me and goes, I got to show you the photos I just took. and like, you know, he's just so eager. And he found, you know, some beautiful pieces of graffiti, some billboards, some people, some babushkas peering through a window of a bridal shop. And that's all he wanted to talk about. And I was like, I thought you were kidnapped, man. So I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but I think it gives you some insight.
It certainly endears him to me. I mean,
I like these photos now. I think they're amazing, but now that I know that they were made out of a lack of concern for Matt Gallagher.
I feel like I've met him once before. Was he at the Half King reading we did back in the day?
He was. I think he was there, okay. And I'd met him in an AWP years ago.
Me too. Wasn't Ben in The Wire as well?
Yes.
Y'all still taking a charge for this, you know that? You're a truant.
Next Saturday.
Try Wednesday.
And I'm past trying to see why y'all lying. Me up.
Hey, Carlicio.
Officer Calicchio Shipburn.
He was. He played Officer
Calicchio. Calicchio. I know this.
Calicchio, yeah.
I know this because when you mentioned his hair, I immediately Googled him. But listener, it does not disappoint, let me tell you. There's one shot in particular where it's just like he's in full Fabio mode, and it's like flowing behind him, extraordinary. But the other picture that comes up is him on The Wire. We'll leave it to people to discover which character he played. But obviously, a modern Renaissance man and an extraordinary photographer.
One more quick story about Ben and what an asset he was. We were in Odessa, and I was having a real hard time getting a special operations soldier to Ukrainian to open up. He was just kind of giving me real basic talking points of like, oh, no, I've killed 100 Russians. Like he wants Esquire to make him famous, but he's not going to give me anything real. And then it kind of comes out that he wants to be an actor. So Ben starts talking to him as his Wire character. And then the guy recognizes him and like starts shouting in Ukraine. Oh, it's my favorite show, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, once he calmed down, gave me one of the best interviews I've ever had. And it was because he had that switch, right? Like more than your regular war photographer could not do that. I was a lucky guy every day, but especially that day.
This is the power of celebrity. You know, it cuts through.
it speaks to that. It does.
War, the aura of war is no match for I was on an HBO show. And amazing.
Arguably the best show ever, too. Like, not just any HBO show. It's definitely in the conversation.
It's up there, yeah. Matt, thank you for coming.
Matt, this is fantastic.
My pleasure, guys. Really, really enjoy the conversation. Keep up the great work.
Buy Matt's book.
We'd also like to thank Fairfield University for sponsoring Manifesto, a podcast. Fairfield is a Jesuit university in Fairfield, Connecticut, whose mission is to develop the creative intellectual potential of students and to foster in them ethical and religious values and a sense of social responsibility. I also teach there, so it's great to be associated with Fairfield, and we thank them for their sponsorship.
And from that point of view, it's most improbable that anyone will ever know exactly who is enjoying the shadow of whom.
I've given our objector his fair share of program time.
When these men talk, I never know whether to regard him as a man of genius or as an ape of genius.